We're also pleased to have here back on the program a couple of guests. Both of them have been here before on the show. They're both from the College of Veterinary Medicine at U of I, Stephen Marks and Julia Whittington. And this is one of those programs we do from time to time we call Talk to the Veterinarian. It's an opportunity for you to call in and ask questions about your companion animals, whatever they might be. Dogs, cats mostly, but if you have something a little bit more exotic, we have someone, I think, who can deal with some of those questions. And in fact, Dr. Whittington is the person who's really responsible for dealing with the wild animal part of what they do over at the vet school here at the U of I. We could talk a little bit about that. And we really want them, we ask them to be here to be a resource for you. So if you have questions, give us a call, and I know that they will do their best to give you an answer. 333-9455, that's for folks here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Thank you very much for being here.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
One basic thing you suggest we might talk a little bit about to start has to do with the heat, and for those animals, and I guess primarily here we'll be talking about dogs who may be spending time outside or who don't mind taking a ride, or maybe even like the idea of taking a ride, and might be left in cars. We really need to get across to people that animals need to have shelter from the sun. They need to have adequate water just like we do. And you really have to be very careful about leaving them in a vehicle.
Absolutely. I mean, that's unfortunately a mistake that you often make once and you don't get a second chance because it really puts the pet in a life-threatening situation.
So is it okay? I think some people probably think, well, if they leave the animal in the car and they leave the windows down so that some air gets through, that's okay. Is that okay?
It's probably not. I mean, if you just think about yourself, if you get into your car, even if you left the windows down, the temperatures inside the car are often much more elevated than outside the car. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really a bad idea. I mean, even leaving the engine running with air conditioning on is not a guarantee that the inside ambient temperature will remain cool enough.
Okay. And what for dogs particularly, I guess here I'm thinking again, who are going to be spending time outside during the daytime, what sort of things should you think about to make sure that they're going to be comfortable?
Well, you always have to have water available for them, fresh, clean water. And it's also a good idea to give them some sort of shade, whether that's by means of a shelter or a shade tree. You also want to make sure that how you have them secured is going to be safe for that animal. You wouldn't want a chain that could become wrapped around a tree if they chose to chase a squirrel or any sort of mechanism that's going to be potentially harmful for them. We unfortunately see a lot of these collars that have actually torn into or bitten into the neck of some of these animals if they're too tight or their neck gets a little swollen. The other thing we have to worry about in these warm temperatures are ectoparasites like fleas and ticks, and mm-hmm. You know that can be very uncomfortable to some of these outside animals.
Okay. Well, I tell you what, we have a caller here. Rather than make them wait, we'll get right to it. And they are listening this morning in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Good morning, everyone. Great mm-hmm. to hear from you. You said the magic word, and the magic word is ticks. We found our first tick this weekend and finally got it off, but we had a devil of a time with it. The old strategy that I've heard before is to get a little rubbing alcohol and just kind of soak the area, and the tick should die and fall off, and that didn't work. We didn't want to pull too hard to dislodge it because we know that the head will get stuck, and that's no good. It just so happens that we had some of the once-a-month flea and tick medication, and so we actually applied that. It was the beginning of the month, so we applied that, and the tick did eventually die, and we were able to take it out. But I was wondering if there are any other methods for getting rid of ticks should they clamp on tight to your dog. And I'll go ahead and listen offline. Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you. That's a great question. I mean, the reality is the best way for us to deal with ticks in this area, because we really don't see a ton of ticks in this area compared to some other geographic regions, is to really be diligent about your preventative. And the once-a-month products that are out there are very nice. You just need to make sure if you're bathing your dog, if you're not using one of the waterproof products, that you reapply. And that's worth talking to your veterinarian about. Removal, for the most part, people will use alcohol. What also works is just a little bit of vegetable oil. And we do try to remove them if we can, only because the longer the tick is embedded, the greater the possibility of transmission of disease. And that's really – the tick itself really doesn't cause much harm. It's just the transmission of tick-borne disease that we're most concerned about. Again, in this area, we do not see a large number of cases of tick-borne disease. And we're talking primarily about Borrelia or Lyme disease and Ehrlichia. Those are the big diseases that we're concerned about.
Okay. It seems to me that there are a number of products available for animals to try to protect them against fleas and ticks. And there are things that are applied on the surface, and then there are things that are systemic. Do you have recommendations on what kind of product you think works best?
Yeah, most of the products right now that we recommend are the topical. I mean, for ticks, for the most part, we're using a topical that can have systemic effects, so it can be absorbed through the skin. Mm-hmm. But the topical is probably the best, and it's either it comes as a top spot application or a spray, because it lasts a month and it has very good protection for fleas, and at least most of the products have protection for ticks. We are fortunate in this area because we don't have a lot of ticks that we haven't seen some of the tick resistances that they have in other parts of the country, where some products that we think work are not working quite as well. Mm-hmm. So I would stick with a topical.
And if you do that and you do it the way that you're supposed to do it, you think that would be as good as something that would be in the animal system. And then tick or flea comes along, bites the animal, gets some of this stuff and...
I mean, it's a very good – so there really aren't very many products on the market, as far as I know, that are systemic for tick prevention. The flea, because the flea ingests blood, those products are available. The problem with that is that tick has to actually bite the animal to get the product to die. And so for you or I, if we have a pet that is – we can still control most of the problems with the fleas, but as soon as they bite, if it's an animal that is hypersensitive or allergic to the fleas, they're still going to have the reaction even though you've killed the flea.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And do these things that are topical actually get rid of fleas or discourage them even from getting on the animal in the first place?
Exactly.
Oh, okay. Okay. Let's talk with someone here next in Mattoon. This is line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm wondering if we could get into some behavioral issues as well as just physical health.
Sure.
Okay. I have 3 cats, 2 female, about 6 years old, and a male about 5 years old. They get along really well. We have one large litter box that they all share. Use a scoopable litter, clean it at least once a day, sometimes twice a day. In the last few months or so, the male cat, and I finally caught who it was, and it's definitely him, will, instead of urinating directly into the litter, will be standing up and basically peeing behind it.
That a boy.
Point where I had to put a sheet of plastic up to protect what was behind it. And I don't know what has prompted this behavior and what to do about it.
That's a challenging area and probably one of the more common behavioral problems that we see with cats. So neither Dr. Whittington or myself are behaviorists, and there are behaviorists in the country, so I'll give you some recommendations to talk to your local veterinarian about.
Okay.
For the most part, it'd probably be a good idea to actually get at least 2 or potentially 3 litter boxes. That may be a quick fix.
Mm-hmm.
Where we always start with behavioral problems is to make sure that there's not organic disease to begin with. And so it may be worthwhile at least visiting your veterinarian with the male cat and make sure that he has nothing easy to fix, such as a cystitis. With your description, it's unlikely that there's a problem there. But if there is lower urinary tract disease, so cystitis is an infection of the bladder, urethritis is infection or inflammation is the better term of the urethra, calculi or stones within the bladder, all those could cause a cat to urinate or void inappropriately. But with your description, it really sounds behavioral.
Yeah. It's not all the time. It's just occasionally, but regular enough that it's a real pain.
Well, yeah, and as we all know, you know, cat urine is fairly odoriferous and not ideal to have in your household if you can avoid it.
Right.
So the simple fixes would be to give an additional litter box.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that would be number one. The other things to look at is there's a number of products out there, both oral medications, and there's some aerosolized and topical medications that can be used that contain feline pheromones. That seem to reduce the stress in the environment, and usually this is you know typically some type of dominant submission atmosphere. Even if the cats appear to be getting along, there's probably times during the day that they're doing some activities that you're not sure you don't know about.
He definitely likes to try and exhibit his dominance. In fact, he engages in contests with me even at different times about over different things. So, yeah, he likes being the alpha male.
Well, I think – so again, the easiest thing to do is change litter boxes. And even – so I would at least put a second litter box in there, see if that helps. If it doesn't, cats don't really tolerate behavioral modification the way dogs do. So, I mean, pretty much cats do what they like, right? We know that and we accept that. And the medications on their own don't usually work without some other type of environmental modification. So I would start with that. I talk to your local veterinarian. I will tell you the closest behaviorist in this region is Purdue, which is an hour and a half to 2 hours away. Mm-hmm. And they will take consult calls at a minimum from your veterinarian. Okay. With recommendations. But there's a lot of different drugs out there that we can use systemically that in combination with the environmental changes may help.
Okay. Could I ask another question?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Also, same three cats. They get dry food. We don't let them out. So they're basically indoor cats. So we use an indoor formula cat food for them. The one female has, and all three cats are neutered and always have been. The one female is just really large. She's probably 20 pounds, and the other two cats are normal. We leave the bowls of dry food out, and I really don't know how to go about reducing the weight of the one cat without starving the other two, who have, you know, are actually slender. So any hints on how I can do that?
That's actually a very difficult scenario. There's not going to be an easy way. You're going to have to limit the food or increase the activity for the big cat. Mm-hmm. And what you see is that the demographic that we have in our own population of people is that there's one person that eats this amount and another person that eats this amount, and then one is thin and one is not. Mm-hmm. The reality is any animal species gains weight. It's calories in versus calories out. It's not rocket science.
Mm-hmm.
And so you either have to find a way to get more calories out, meaning that you have to develop some exercise regime for your cat, which, again, you know, we know that that's probably not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So it really means reducing the food. And what you're probably going to have to do is just put the food down, and then after the cats eat, pull it away.
Okay.
And then you're going to condition them to eat several times a day, and hope that the big cat is not pushing away the little cats. If the little cats look like they're getting littler,
mm-hmm.
then you're going to have to feed these animals separately. You're going to have to basically segregate them when you're feeding.
All righty. Thank you very much for your help.
Well, thanks for the call. Is it a general recommendation if you have more than one cat that every cat should have its own litter box?
The general recommendations vary among behaviorists, but in general, they say that you should have at least one litter box per cat. Now, it's difficult in some households to have five litter boxes if you have multiple cats. Mm-hmm. But when you start to have some of these behavioral problems, that would be the definite first step to take in order to try to get those behavior problems under control. A lot of times cats will guard litter boxes. That's a territory issue. That's a resource for them. And if a cat is dominant and wants to stay dominant over its housemates, that would be a good place for it to show its dominance. So giving them multiple areas that they can use, multiple resources to guard, makes it more difficult to do so.
Okay. Our guests this morning are Julia Whittington and Stephen Marks. They're veterinarians here at the U of I College of Vet Medicine. And if you have questions about companion animals, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Aurora on our line number one. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Mm-hmm.
Good morning. I got a dog, a Cocker Spaniel, from the animal welfare about 5 years ago. And it turned out that this Cocker Spaniel is very, very high maintenance. He has conjunctivitis. He has problems with his teeth. His biggest problem, I think, and I would like some help with, is his anxiety. He will wake up during the night and cry, and then I have to, he wakes me up, and then I tell him, it's okay, Duffy, it's okay. You know, I console him. Is there any, and of course these kind of things happen during the day too. Is there anything that really works? I go through the Foster magazine that comes from Wisconsin, and they have some products that you can give your dog and water. Do they really work? Would any of them might work with this dog with his high anxiety?
Well, I mean, it's hard to know if it'll work. I mean, Foster's a great catalog, has a lot of veterinary products. I think the problem that you're dealing with is that you don't know what the problem you're dealing with is.
He was like that when I got him. He had the high anxiety. He was kept in a kennel for the first 5 years of his life. When I got him from the animal welfare, he didn't know how to walk up steps or down steps. He didn't know a lot of things to do, and I, you know, taught him how to do everything. He's a very good watchdog.
Oh, I bet. I mean, Cocker Spaniels are very, you know, they're a very nice breed of dog to deal with.
Well, I'll tell you, I won't say that anymore.
Yes.
This dog, you know, by the time I scrub his teeth, brush his teeth twice a day, and get them cleaned once a year, and the one problem that I was told I was going to have was his ears, but I keep them clean, and I have no problems with his ears.
Well, yeah.
But I do with his eyes, his mouth, his teeth. And now he has lesions over his body, little raised lesions that the vet said that's no problem. It's just something that he has. And he's very difficult to handle. I'm trying to cut his fur off to give him a summer clip, and that's almost impossible. So I thought if I could give him something that might work just to lower his anxiety level a little bit, it would help.
Well, my concern is I don't know what the etiology or the cause of the suspected anxiety is. I mean, it sounds like it could absolutely be behavioral, but I'd want to make sure that there's not something that's going on.
What could be the matter?
I mean, the signs of a lot of diseases will look very similar. So it's possible that these skin lesions, for example, may be bothering him more than we suspect.
And yeah, I told the vet about him because he goes to the vet very frequently. In fact, he's going next Monday to have his teeth cleaned. I asked her about the lesion. She says they're not a problem.
Okay.
That's what she told me.
And so he's not scratching at the lesions?
No, nothing like that.
Okay.
Nothing.
I mean, so to answer your question, I mean, there are anti-anxiety drugs out there, but they're not drugs that you would want to give a dog for the rest of their life. I mean, they're the same anti-anxiety drugs that we use in people. So drugs like diazepam or Valium would be a classic.
Oh, I'd never give them Valium.
Well, right. So it's – I mean, dogs can take Valium, but they don't want to take it every day for the rest of their lives. And so the natural
– I want to have him clipped, and what I'm doing to save the woman that will do it, I am trying to get off as much fur as I can so that when she works with him, there's not that much left. And so I've been working on him, but it hasn't been very successful.
Yeah, that's difficult. And in an anxious dog, that may make him a little bit more anxious. But that may make him a little bit more anxious, forcing him to, you know, into being shaved.
Yes.
So, again, to try to answer your question as far as Foster's product, as far as I know, there's not a product over the counter that you can give that will act as an anti-anxiety drug that works very well.
There are several in the book that they claim, and I thought, well, I don't feel like giving them $15 and that it doesn't work.
Well, it may be worth trying it, but I would consult with it. I'd have to know the specific product that they're offering, and that would be something to compare. If you're going in to see your veterinarian next week, then I would bring the catalog and ask that veterinarian.
It's a dog.
Exactly. Oh, I'm sorry.
It's a Cocker Spaniel.
Yeah. Right, I'm sorry.
Yes, okay.
So when you bring your dog in next week, if you would ask your veterinarian specifically bring that product and see what that veterinarian knows about that product, and if it's not, if it's nothing that will do harm, then it potentially may be worth giving a shot. What I'm telling you is the efficacy of those products is really unknown, meaning no one knows if they work.
Well, I'll tell you this. I've worked very hard with this dog because I realize it's a problem. And the vet says he's come a long, long way. He's come a long way, she said, because she used to take care of him when he had his former owner.
Well,
but I don't know what more to do.
Well, it sounds like you've done a very nice job. I mean, it sounds like you've put a lot of work into this pet and that he's come into a very nice household. Your veterinarian can recommend there's at least one behaviorist in the Chicagoland area. There's also several neurologists in the the Chicagoland area that will do behavior as well. There's specifically a neurologist in Aurora. So it may be worth consulting with them and seeing if they have some recommendations. They'll probably say they'd like to see the pet and then make some medical recommendations or some behavioral modification.
I wish I knew. Oh, well, I'll try something. I'm going to call the vet right after this program goes off.
All right.
Thank you much.
Well, good luck.
Bye-bye.
We are already at our midpoint here. We have another caller, and we'd certainly invite others. If you have questions about companion animals, give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guests are Dr. Stephen Marks and Dr. Julie Whittington, both from the U of I College of Vet Medicine here in Urbana-Champaign. Let's go to someone else here, someone in Champaign. They're next, line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I would like to suggest to the previous caller that she at least give a try to Dr. Bach's Rescue Remedy. That is a non-prescription item. There's nothing in it that will hurt at all. I have used it quite successfully with a dog who is very anxious about thunderstorms, and it's something that you can use as needed. It's not one that I don't know. I've never had a veterinarian tell me about it, but I do know a lot of breeders use it, and I had one friend who said, oh, I don't give it to the dog before a dog show and I'm taking the dog in. I take it myself. But I would just like to say that that is a sort of nonspecific herbal, I suppose, flower essences remedy that does work in some cases. If you haven't ever run into it, you ought to look into it.
Do you guys have any experience with it?
We've actually seen it's not something that most veterinarians would prescribe because, as you indicated, it's not necessarily a medicinal compound. It is an herbal product. And I do have some owners who give their rabbits this particular product, and they swear that it does cause some calming effect to the rabbit. Of course, rabbits, we deal with a situation where they get very stressed, especially if anything in their environment changes, including coming to the veterinarian.
Yeah. So it worked wonders on my old dog who, after a while, just developed a terrible anxiety about thunderstorms.
Mm-hmm. I would tell you just that a lot of these herbal remedies, while they have some benefit, and certainly the field is growing and the knowledge that we have about these products is growing, it's important to understand that they're not all without side effects. So you have to be very concerned about the product you're using and its potential complications. And if there is organic disease, so if there's liver failure or kidney failure or some other disease in this pet, using these products isn't necessarily always safe. So
no, that's very true. But this is in an otherwise monitored animal.
Mm-hmm.
I think that this is, it's holistic medicine, and I know a lot of physicians and veterinarians don't really believe in all of this natural stuff, but this is a product that I have seen work time and time and time again, and I just thought it might be worthwhile just to mention it for this person.
Absolutely.
Okay. Great. All right.
I'm not giving recommendations. I'm just saying that the product is there, and it has a record of success.
And I would tell you that there are quite a few veterinarians who are versed in holistic medicine, and it would definitely be worth your while, as well as the caller from Aurora, to try to find one of these contacts. They're very, very helpful, and they are usually quite willing to do consults with veterinarians over the phone.
Yes, I have found that. And thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you. On we go to Champaign. Next, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have a Boston Terrier pug mix. And I guess it's kind of in the same subject matter as your other calls, but she's a wonderful dog. She loves everybody, but she is very excitable. I mean, I'm in a position where I can take her to work, and she demands anyone who walks by. I mean, she just has to be petted. If somebody's coming, like, to my door, she's just so excitable. And I call her my life force because she's just a happy, happy dog. And it's like, but it's such a high pitch of excitability. And then, you know, she'll calm. Like, when somebody comes to the door, basically I just pick her up, and I just ask him if she can sniff their hand or lick their hand or whatever, because she loves everybody. But her excitability, and I've never had a dog like this. I've always had labs or hound mixes or spaniels. And I'm just wondering if there's anything. We've gone through dog obedience, and I just always steered away from drugs. I'm not a big proponent of that, but and I guess what's really brought it to my attention is I've been off of work a few days here because I moved, and I can tell tomorrow when we're going to go back, she's just going to think, wow, you know, I got to greet and meet everyone. And I just, you know, I want her to be happy. I don't want to change her personality, but it's just like if I could take her down a notch, and I just don't know if there's anything to you could recommend.
Yeah, again, it's more of a behavioral modification. What happens in these situations, if you talk to behaviorists, is we're reinforcing the behavior. So she acts up because she wants to greet people, and we allow her to greet people, and then and it's perpetuated. So yeah. There are behavioral modifications. There are, I mean, the obedience training, you know, over time, and it may be that that course needs to be repeated, where they'll make the dog stand and not react to, at least not react that excitably to someone that's approaching the pet owner and the pet.
Boy, I don't know. You know, it's like, I mean, I've tried to channel her energy to tricks. I mean, she's a very smart little dog. And but she is, and you pet her, but it's fine. That's it. She's done. Okay. But she just, in fact, they put a big sign on my cubicle, a hall monitor, that nobody can pass unless they greet Lily, because she is just so, you know, and they've been, but I don't know, when you say reinforce, it's like, what are you supposed to do? I mean, other than, you know, obviously, like even today I went out, I came back, she was just so excited to see me. And it's almost like I call her my autistic child. I have to, like, body hug her and just say, you know, it's okay, hello, hello, and then just put her down and walk away. I mean, I don't accentuate the greeting, because it seems like, you know, initial, like, just like tough love, you just kind of give her a hug and walk away. She calms down and then goes, picks up her toys, and that's it. And other than doing that, I it's like I'm at a loss, other than, you know, people have mentioned Prozac and all that, and it's like, oh, I don't really want to go that route. But you think it's just, and she's 6 years old, so you think behavior training of some sort might help? Or?
I think the older the pet is, the more difficult the behavioral modification will be.
Sure.
I mean, that, and it would take a lot of work, and it would take you seeing a behaviorist. And most veterinarians do not have specific training in that area that are general practitioners. Medication, again, in my opinion, is not the answer.
Right.
Only 25% of cases respond to medical therapy alone.
Oh.
So even when you use medical therapy, it needs to be used in combination with appropriate behavioral modification.
Uh-huh.
There's lots of information on behavioral modification on the internet as well, but I think you're better off at least having your veterinarian speak with a specialist in the area.
Okay.
Going with drugs like Prozac, I mean, they can act as anti-anxiety drugs, but then you're pretty much going to be medicating your dog every day, or at least the days you go to work, forever.
Yeah.
Which is not really an appropriate quality of life.
And I mean, she's a wonderful dog. She, you know, and all that. It's just those moments of initial greeting that, you know, thank God they love her at work. I tell you, sometimes she can really be a pistol, but then, like I say, she calms down and such. So, okay, well, I just thought, you know, I'd give you a call and see if I can get any further insight into her. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, well, thank you. Good luck.
Okay,
let's go on here to Champaign County. We have a caller here on line number 3. Hello.
Yes, hello. This is a question for Dr. Whittington. I have a really current question as of this morning. I had some contractors working, and even with warning, they still managed to take a bird nest without looking out of the area where they were working and throw it down on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And after they left, I found one little bird that had been killed, two that are still in it. I think that they look all right. They're now peeping and chirping.
Mm-hmm.
What was left of the nest, gathered around them, put it in a box, put it up high on a garbage can on this porch, mm-hmm. with the hope that the robin would come back and find them.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen no activity in that direction in the last 2 hours,
mm-hmm.
and this is where I always wondered, at this point, what do I do?
Mm-hmm.
Do I bring them to you? They're way too young to fly. They're just pretty little yet, and, you know, they're peeping and asking for food.
Mm-hmm.
What's the right thing to try to do?
Was the nest originally on the porch?
Yeah, it was up in the eaves, which they were repairing the eaves, and they just pulled it out from under the eaves and threw it down.
Mm-hmm. Is there any way to replace it back up into the eaves?
I think I could probably do that. How am I going to know if the mother comes back or not?
what the mother's not going to come back while you're watching. There's no question about that. She knows that you're there and you're a predator to her. So what you need to do
I'm watching from inside the house, hopefully where I'm not seen.
Okay.
Maybe she sees me. I don't know.
Yeah. What I would recommend is trying to get the nest back as close as possible to where it came from. And if the babies are still fairly active and don't seem lethargic, they're still responding anytime the nest is vibrated, so they're responding to any motion, then they're still doing fairly well. You can try to position some grass or straw or some sort of material that the mother would displace, not the babies, but that the mother would have to displace to return to the nest, and then check it in about 2 to 4 hours. And if that material's been displaced, then you know the mom's been back. And if the babies are still active and chirping, then the mom's most likely been back. If you check in about 4 hours and that material's still in place, or the babies are seeming to be less strong, then I think you need to intervene. And I would call the Department of Natural Resources, and they would be able to direct you to a wildlife rehabilitator who's licensed to care for migratory birds.
Do you have a number for them?
I don't know it off the top of my head, but if you look in the, I guess it's the red pages, the government pages, it would be listed under State of Illinois.
Under State of Illinois.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Department of Natural Resources.
Well, I'll try to do that then. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
Good luck.
Thanks.
Bye.
This was one of the things that you said, Julia, that you would like to at least have a chance to talk about, because at this time of year, the kind of scenario that the caller sketches out is likely to happen, or maybe the wind comes along, blows a nest out of the tree, or you're doing something working outside and you don't really realize it, and so you have this problem, and now you have a baby animal that is out of its regular place, has been disturbed, you don't know, maybe it's been hurt, and you want to try to do the right thing, and you want to try to help.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, that's great. It's good that we help our wildlife animals. The problem that we run into, though, is that oftentimes we find these babies and they're healthy, and we intervene when in reality Mother Nature would still take care of them. So ideally, when you find a situation where you know that the nest has been disturbed, maybe it's fallen out of a tree, maybe like this last caller, you had some inadvertent destruction occur, it's best to try to put those animals back into the natural setting. So sometimes if the nest is completely destroyed, you can recreate a nest with a Tupperware tub, poke holes in the bottom and fill it with nesting material, and then try to get those animals back as close in proximity as you can to where they originally came from. And then this caller had a really good idea. Monitor that nest for activity, but from a distance, because if we sit there and watch, the parent's not going to return. The other thing to understand is some wild parents actually don't visit their young more than once or twice a day. And they do this simply to avoid drawing attention to the nest. For instance, fawns are born without odor, and their parents will actually put them in a place to hide them and not return for quite some time. And because they don't have odor, predators aren't drawn to them. So if you happen across a fawn and there's no parent around, that doesn't mean they're abandoned. So really the best thing to do if the animal looks healthy, active, alert, warm, moving, is to leave it alone and not intervene. On the other hand, if you see an animal that's been attacked by a domestic cat or has an obvious injury, then that's when you should intervene and bring it to either the wildlife clinic or to a licensed rehabilitator.
Okay.
The worst thing to do is actually take that animal into your home, let your kids play with it, and try to raise it on your own, because that is a recipe for disaster. Not only can these animals defend themselves and cause injury to us, they carry some diseases that can cause disease in us, and oftentimes we're left with animals that are not able to be returned to the wild.
And I'm sure that while people do bring animals to you, mm-hmm. that you would rather that they not do that, I suppose.
Yes. Certainly if they have a medical injury, we welcome them to bring the animals to us. Yeah. We do not charge for that service. We are housed in the small animal clinic at the College of Vet Med, and we are available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That is our goal. We want to provide medical care for these animals. But if they're healthy, we are a medical facility, and so by bringing healthy animals in, we're exposing them to potential for disease.
Okay. Well, let's talk with some of the folks here. I think we have a Champagne caller on line 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi, I am not yet a dog owner, but may become one. My 10-year-old daughter has a burning desire for a Bichon Frise and has had one for several years. So we've waited for this desire to go away, but it's not. And my husband and I have several concerns about how seriously our lifestyle will have to be altered to make this dog happy. So I'm wondering in general about lifestyle alterations and also if there's anything particular to Bichon Frises that would make our lifestyle alterations worse or better. We're especially worried that we may never get to sleep late again on a Saturday or Sunday for the next 15 years. We work late into the night every night and need to sleep late on weekends just so we don't die of exhaustion. And there are some days when we're both away for, you know, maybe 6 or even 8 hours during the day, and I don't want to make a sad and lonely neurotic dog, so I'm also wondering in general how long a dog, and in particular how long a Bichon Frise can go during the day without really becoming sad and lonely. We're also thinking of going away for a year, in about a year and a half, and I'm thinking about transatlantic flights and how young is too young to bring a new dog along on a very long ride and then change its life entirely for a year.
First of all, I would like to thank you for thinking of all these questions before you get your pet. That is tremendously awesome. It's amazing how many people get the pet and then think about these questions.
We've been thinking about them for 3 years as our daughter, you know, every week begs us, when can we get this dog?
Well, they're all excellent questions. There's a tremendous number of resources out there, both on the internet. You can go to the AVMA, which is the American Veterinary Medical Association website, and there are notes on, or at least tips on pet owners and pet owning.
Okay.
And that's worth looking at. The lifestyle changes will be there for sure. I don't think there's anything specific to a Bichon that you would have to be concerned about. Certainly. Yeah, it just depends if you like smaller dogs, smaller active dogs versus bigger active dogs.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the specific lifestyle changes, I think that's worth a family chat as far as your daughter's involvement.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is the age that, you know, that type of responsibility is going to be important. And although the child often wants the pet, they don't know everything that it entails.
Mm-hmm.
It is nice to be able to take dogs for walks at least 3 to 4 times a day.
Mm-hmm.
Do all of us do that? No, I can, myself included. I mean, I have a golden retriever that is the size of like 20 Bichon Frises. But they are very adaptable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, generically, it's very difficult to leave a pet by itself all day, and that mm-hmm. should be avoided if you can. But they wind up doing pretty well,
mm-hmm.
especially if there's a lot of activity in the times that people are home.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you're going to be someone that leaves a dog in a crate all day,
mm-hmm.
and then you come home from work and you're pretty tired and you don't really want to take the pet for a walk,
mm-hmm.
and your daughter has homework to do, and then there's no real social interaction there, then that's probably not going to be a good scenario.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Traveling restrictions for pets are, again, lots of information on the internet. There's federal standards for allowing pets to travel. It depends on the size of the dog when the pet travels more than the age for the most part. If it is a small enough pet to fit in a pet carrier that will go under a seat,
mm-hmm.
then that makes life very easy for you because then they're in the environment that you and your family are flying,
mm-hmm.
and they're not really at risk.
Mm-hmm.
If it is a larger pet and they have to be in a pet carrier and go with cargo, then there are – most often there's health restrictions. In a young dog, it should not be a problem. But there are also temperature restrictions. There are
mm-hmm.
certain times of the year that the ambient temperature cannot exceed. Right now, I believe it's 85 degrees. That may be lowered for some airlines. I mean, there is a risk of flying a pet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there definitely is a risk, and you have to be concerned about that.
Mm-hmm.
But that stress on them will be over as soon as the flight is over.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's really hard to know how an individual pet will respond.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, each pet is a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
So those are really the parameters that you're asking about. Sleeping late on the weekends may be a little bit of a challenge. It's, you know, depending upon how late you take the pet out the night before, they're going to probably be up pretty early wanting to go out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that may be as simple as opening up the door and letting them run in the backyard if you have an enclosed backyard for a couple of minutes and letting them back in, no big deal, or
mm-hmm.
may involve actually getting up, walking around the block.
Mm-hmm. So one question we have is if we normally would walk the pet, let's say, at 10 at night and then 7 in the morning during the week, would the pet be adaptable enough for us to walk it, let's say, at midnight on Friday and Saturday and then not get up till 9 the next day, or are they going to want the same routine every
they're
day?
Gonna probably, you're going to probably have trained them to want that routine.
Uh-huh.
They are
they
smart.
They won't know about weekends.
Yeah, that's it. They're very smart, but they, you know, weekend is just another day.
Yeah.
I mean, and maybe your child's different than mine, but I can tell you my kids don't appreciate the weekend either.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's pretty much, you know, 6 a.m., they're up and, you know, they're ready to roll, whether mm-hmm. it's a Saturday, Sunday, or Monday.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And lifespan of Bichon Frises, we're thinking, you know, how many years after our daughter's off to college, in 8 years, will this delightful pet be ours?
No, hopefully, with medical care, yes. I mean, the bottom line is the average lifespan for dogs right now approaches 10 years. Bichon Frise, they're a pretty hardy breed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we have dogs that die younger, and we have dogs that, you know, go older. You may have, mm-hmm. you know, may have this dog for quite a while. You may have this dog through college graduation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I think those are things you need to look at.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. And last question, in terms of moving a dog to another country for a year, what would you say would be the youngest one would want to do that and not really mess the dog up?
For the most part, they're really going to have to be at least over 6 months of age.
Oh, okay. All right.
I mean, there's really, if the younger dogs, I mean, they're fairly adaptable and it's not going to be a problem. You
mm-hmm.
want it, the one thing I would emphasize is you need to check both ends, meaning
mm-hmm.
you need to make sure the travel arrangements on this side are appropriate
mm-hmm.
and the receiving area on the other end is appropriate and that they have no restrictions for
mm-hmm.
pets.
Okay.
For example, some countries would restrict you bringing in a pet from America since we have endemic rabies and they may not if you're going to an island country, for example,
mm-hmm.
and the pet may have to be in quarantine for 6 months to a year, which is not
Yikes.
Ideal.
Wow. And optimal time to bring a new puppy into our home if we have control over such things?
I don't think there is a time. I mean, I would bring it at a time that your household is as stable as it can be. So if
okay.
there's a lot of flux, any changing, any big stresses coming up, big parties, big events,
okay.
Try and avoid those because
okay.
it's just one more complicating
okay.
factor.
For how long do you suppose?
Oh, no, I mean,
a quiet lifestyle.
No, I mean, it doesn't sound like you have a very quiet lifestyle to begin with. So there just needs to be a period of time when you introduce the pet for the first, I would say, month or so that they bond with you and your family.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Thanks for the call. Well, we have a couple of other folks here. Our guests this morning, Stephen Marks, Julia Whittington from the U of I College of Vet Medicine. If you have questions about animal care, that's what we're doing here. And I know they will do their best to give you an answer. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Next, we'll talk with someone in Crete, Illinois, on our line 4. Hello.
Hello. I have a number of cats, and since cats have special problems with kidneys, I wondered if distilled water, this is the first of three questions, I wonder if distilled water would be better for them than the regular tap water or anything else.
I would say no. In fact, unless there's something specific about the tap water in your area you're concerned about, there's no benefit of distilled water.
We have two cats that don't like the ID necklace around their necks. They become almost berserker regarding it. I wondered if we gave them an ID chip and one cat felt that chip was bothersome to him or her, would that cat be driven completely mad until that chip was taken out?
I mean, really, most pets tolerate the chips very well because that's placed subcutaneously, so under the skin. And although there have been some mild complications with it, most cats don't even know they've received it.
And finally, one cat seems to attack the other cat with a great deal of diligence. I was wondering, we use a little water pistol once in a while to calm the cat down who is attacking the other cat. Is that a behavior modification acceptable?
It is, actually. It doesn't hurt the cat, and it lets them know that what they're doing is inappropriate. So that is one of the mechanisms that people have used to let them know. And that's probably one of the easiest ones that you can use.
Well, I thank you for your advice.
All right. Thank you. Over to Munster, Indiana for the next caller. It's line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Hi. I was calling because the woman that was thinking about taking a pet overseas that called previous to the last caller,
mm-hmm.
My uncle passed away in the UK, and I brought his Papillon home to the United States, and I was able to take him on the airline and put him just underneath the seat because he was so small. But I went through their pet scheme in order to be able to take him back to the UK to visit. And I went through all the information, had him tagged. I had a chip put in, all kinds of things I had to go through. And I came to find out that I couldn't take him on the plane with me if I went back. So I wouldn't, if somebody's traveling to the UK, you cannot take a pet on the plane with you, no matter what. You can take them out of the country, but you can't take them into the country. They are not allowed in the cabin. So that's just for anybody's information.
They're allowed to travel, just not in the cabin.
Not in the cabin.
Yeah, I actually am unaware of that. That surprises me. That, are you sure that was – do you know what airline you flew?
I flew United. And the only – and they're not even – they're not authorized to bring an animal into the UK. They can fly them out. But they're not an authorized carrier to bring them into the UK. The only carriers are American Airlines and British Airways, and both of them do not allow pets in the cabin.
And when did you do this?
2 weeks ago.
Okay, so that would be pretty up to date information. I mean,
oh yeah,
there was. I mean, the United Kingdom, as far as I know, has changed their quarantine policies.
They have changed their quarantine policies so that they're quarantined in the country that they're in.
Right.
I mean, it took me 6 months, which they would have been there 6 months,
right,
you know, quarantined. But he was quarantined basically in this country, in the United States, but he wasn't put in a kennel or anything.
Right. Well, and that's the difference, because the previous regulations, when you travel to the United Kingdom and England, you basically had to put your pet into a specified governmental kennel.
For
6 months, and then you were able to visit, which was very hard on both the pet and the
mm-hmm.
pet owner. But, I mean, your information, it sounds like it's very up-to-date, so that's valuable to know.
Oh, it is. It definitely is. Believe me. I go there quite often. I have a house there now, and so I go there often. But I'm not going to put, a 10-pound dog in a cargo hold for 8 hours. And I even called the pet scheme, the department of health and services over there in England, and I said, well, what can I do? I said, how can I bring him over? And the only other way I could take him over is on the Queen Mary, and they're only doing that until November, and then they're stopping that.
Okay. Well, I'd emphasize a couple of things. Now, I mean, your information is wonderful, and that's great, and I'm glad you have personal experience with it. But there, my experience would be it's easier to have the pet in the cabin with you because there's minimal risk.
Right.
But I don't think a small dog is at any more risk in a cargo hold than a larger dog. The risks are the same for both pets. So that's a preference that you have been forced into, but it doesn't mean the dog can't travel.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but they cannot go in a cabin.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right.
That's all I had to say. Thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. Well, again, those, it just underscores if you're even thinking about traveling outside of the country with an animal, make sure that you understand the regulations for the place that you're going to, and then make sure you also understand what's going to happen when you turn around and come back. With however you're traveling, make sure that you know exactly what the rules of the carrier are, and then, go from there.
Absolutely.
What about if you're traveling, say you're traveling cross country, say you're going within the United States and you're going by car. Some people do like to travel with their animals. Dogs, I guess, pretty much. I've never known a cat that much like to travel, but dogs can, they're pretty cool about it. Anything in general that you would say in terms of advice for people who are going to be traveling with an animal like that?
I would say that it very much depends on the pet. If you've got a pet who's adaptable and likes to travel, then just make sure you bring that their usual staples, so their food and their water and things like that. Make sure you give them plenty of time to get out and run, so kind of like driving around the country with a toddler, you want to let them out and play. And then, if you have room to bring a customary bed or something that they're used to, that will help make the transition a little easier for them. Some people will travel with their pets in carriers in their cars, and that gives the pet a little more security in case you had to stop quickly or, God forbid, you were in a wreck. That would keep the pet secure and not jumping in front of your sight line of vision, something like that.
There's some purpose-made harnesses for dogs to travel with. I mean, the bottom line is it just takes planning. I think when you're planning your trip, you want to make sure you have enough room for your luggage and whatever else you're carrying and your pet to travel comfortably. If they're not a pet that is just going to lie there comfortably, they need to be restrained. You can't really have something happening unexpected and having a dog in your lap or a cat in your lap while you're driving and putting both of you at risk. You need to know where you're going, so have some idea of hotels along the route that may accept pets and may not, rest areas that actually allow pets to be walked because some do not. And so it really is a planning.
Yeah.
And you just have to think about it. If you want to stop for a meal and go into a restaurant, what are you going to do with your pet? So these are, you know, and actually I'm about to embark on a trip with the kids and the dogs and the cats. So it's fresh on the tip of my tongue.
Okay. Let's try and get one more caller here. Effingham, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I wonder if there's any advice on how to introduce a second cat into the home that already has one cat. My stepson is going to come live with us, and he's bringing with a five-month-old kitten, and we already have a seven-year-old cat living in the house with us. The cat that is with us is, a typical aloof cat, and she sort of thinks she rules the roost. She's not particularly dominant or aggressive, but I'm wondering if there's any advice on how I can introduce them and what I should be expecting and what we can do to mitigate it.
Yeah, I'll give you about a minute, unfortunately, to answer the question. What do you think?
A lot of people will say that you have to introduce these cats very slowly. That's going to be a bit of a challenge. Some people actually advocate keeping the cats completely separate until they become accustomed to the scent of each other, and then allowing them to have maybe a little bit of visual contact before you give them full direct physical contact. And a lot of behaviorists will actually recommend doing this over a period of weeks to months. And so that may not be very practical for an average household. But certainly you want to have supervised interaction between the cats. You're dealing with a five-month-old kitten who's going to be very active and wanting to play with anything that moves, and that may not be appreciated by your cat. So you definitely want to supervise these interactions and intervene before your cat gets so ticked off that she actually takes action, because that will just perpetuate the discomfort or discontentment between the two animals. Definitely multiple cat boxes to avoid any competition for resources, and feed in different areas. And then make sure you give your cat the attention that the other cat's going to try to usurp, and make sure they're both happy and content.
All right, we're going to have to leave it at that. I want to thank you both very much, Drs. Julia Whittington and Stephen Marks, for being here. Stephen, particularly you, because you've been with us a number of times, and you're going. He's leaving the U of I. We're sorry to say. We certainly wish you well in – it's North Carolina?
North Carolina State.
North Carolina State. And I'm sure that in future some other folks from the vet school, we can drag them over here.
Absolutely.
And we'll do the same
show. It's a great show. Thank
you
very much.
Thank you both very much.
Thank
we certainly
you.
Appreciate it.